Nearly 120,000 people petitioned the White House last year requesting the state of Texas be allowed to secede from the United States. Proud of its history, Texas is defiantly, unapologetically a lone ranger. Skeptical outsiders are often offended by much of the state's politics and attitudes, and yet, according to journalist and Texan Erica Greider, they shouldn't be so quick to discount the state. She writes about it in her new book, Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right: What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. The book is published by Public Affairs. Erica Greider, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
What brought you to think about Texas in these terms and to explore its identity?
Well, I kind of started looking at the recent few years. There was this disjunct between this state of Texas and so many other states in the country during the national downturn. It was like living in a parallel universe almost. I mean, I was working for The Economist then and reading the papers every day and seeing just headlines about distress and the housing crisis, financial crisis, unemployment, long-term unemployment, intractable seeming unemployment. And in Texas, we certainly felt that pinch, but we were evading the worst of it, and we've continued to do that for years. So I thought, okay, what's going on in this state? Why are we taking the approach that we take, and is the approach that we take related to the outcome? And that kind of brought me back to the state history, because I think a lot of why we have the approach we have is because of where we've been as a state.
So what is it about that history that gives it so much of its identity, and how does that history help and fortunate and unfortunately give the rest of the country their impression of the state of Texas?
It's funny, with that petition you mentioned, I've always wondered how many of those signatories were Texans and how many were people from other states saying, yeah, you guys go ahead and leave. But, you know, there's a number of things. I'll try to do a quick synopsis since we're on radio. But as you probably know, the state was an independent country for about 9 years. After staging a revolution against Mexico, which was then a young republic. And then between that time and between being annexed, I think less known is the fact that the state, when it became a country, wanted to be annexed and had sort of applied for annexation and got rebuffed several times. So it was left for almost a decade as kind of a ramshackle pseudo-country. I mean, we had a government, we had laws, but we had very little money, very little industry, no infrastructure. So it was difficult to get things started, and people developed this sense of we're all in this together, this very difficult situation together. And that persisted even after we joined. I think there was a tendency to be a little bit wary of the federal government in particular and to think of ourselves as Texans. And today it's not that we're Texans first, Americans second. I think it's definitely Americans first, Texans second. But there is this strong sense of state identity and common purpose.
You make the case in the book that Texas looks more like America's future, perhaps, than any other state, with the possible exception of California. How so?
It's, you know, there's a handful of big states or mega states, as they're summarized, California and Texas being the biggest two, and California is bigger than Texas in population terms. But if you look at them, at the demographics, the ethnic diversity of these states, the youth of the states, the urbanization of these states, but also the fact that they have a lot of rural space, you kind of see a microcosm of what the U.S. will look like in the future. So, you know, Texas, for example, became a majority-minority state about 10 years ago. Looking at population trends, we think that'll be true about the United States as a whole, maybe in 25 years. I think that the youth of the state is more of a factor in policy than the ethnicity of the state, but it points to the need for things for Texas to do right now. For example, investing more in our schools and in our workforce. And if we can get these things right at the first pass, then that'll be instructive experience for states that follow these trends later on.
So it becomes almost a training ground for the challenges that the country will face in the future.
Right, exactly. You know, you see changes in the structural economy, for example, around the country and in Texas. This state, for example, is increasingly less of a resource economy, more of a knowledge economy. And in some states, especially in New England, there's been a big knowledge economy for a long time. But for a lot of states, that's also a trend or a pattern we're going to see in the coming decades.
How much of the rap on Texas do you think is well deserved, in the sense that it's a little bit kooky, it's a little bit reactionary, and as I mean, just that the title suggests, big, hot, cheap, and right. How much of that do you think is justified?
Well, yeah, there's a little bit of a swagger in Texas, which might not be the best diplomatic strategy for the state. But I think in a lot of respects, you know, we're not as bad as people seem to think. I mean, when I leave the state and talk to people, the ideas they have, they think it's like this small cadre of oil billionaires who are sitting on top of a huge pile of, you know, poor workers. And that's not really the case. We have 6 of the 20 biggest cities in the country. They're all middle-class cities. They're places where people can move to work, to have a family, to buy a house they can afford still. And we have a lot of problems to look at in the coming decades, but a lot of them are problems that have been historic problems. They're problems that have come from our historic poverty and our historic lack of infrastructure and lack of investment in public resources. So I think that the problems we have, while significant, are not really new, and they're things that we're increasingly in a position to work on.
And politically more moderate than it would be given credit for.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's a bit of cognitive dissonance you get because you're going around the state living your life like a normal person. And, I don't feel personally affected by right-wing, fire-breathing, reactionary policies all the time. We see it play out a lot on budget disputes. I mean, the state is quite fiscally conservative. There's a lot of provisions built into the Constitution and the laws about how much we can spend. So basically what the budget is projected to be, to some extent, determines the policy that we're going to have. But on the other things, and kind of social issues, cultural issues, I think there's more bark than bite there.
And you think of this, of the state of LBJ at one time, of how did that start to move and become more red in nature?
It's interesting, you know, it's kind of an appreciable historical irony that a lot of what today's Republicans are so angry about in Washington can be considered part of the LBJ domestic legacy. I think the thing about LBJ is, you know, he was certainly a liberal and he was a Democrat, and when he became when he came to power, the state was a one-party Democratic state. But the Democrats in Texas weren't quite what we think of as today's Democratic Party. They were pretty fiscally conservative in Texas, socially moderate to liberal. On some issues like labor, they didn't really map onto national norms in the second half of the 20th century. So LBJ was, certainly not the only Texas liberal to come out. You also had huge figures like Sam Rayburn. But he wasn't entirely out of step with a state where Democratic politics were always a little more conservative than national norms.
Well, Ann Richards was your governor for a time. I mean, goodness.
Well, that's right. I mean, she also, you know, she was pretty tough, for example, on crime. She, under her administration, the prison population expanded quite a bit in Texas. So yes, we've had Democrats in power as recently as about 20 years ago. More recently, they've been really, really on the back foot. I think we'll see some start to come out and run for statewide offices, probably not in 2014 so much, but in 2018, and maybe around that point, they'll start to win some back.
The perception that many of us from out of the state have of Texas comes from the writings of Jim Hightower or Molly Ivins, and is that, how fair is that, and does that help or ultimately hurt the state?
Well, I think they're from they're definitely from the tradition of sort of holding the state accountable for the areas where it falls short, and I think it's healthy in any kind of political system to have people who are speaking out against the people who are in power, regardless of which party's holding power at the time. I think it's good for debate and good for discussion, and good to have the other side stating its views, at least in journalism, if not in the legislature itself. I think that certainly, I think when Molly Ivins was writing, and Hightower is still writing and still speaking, but I think what they were critiquing about the state, some of the backwardness they described in the state, was more true in the past than it is now.
And that has come through demographic change, do you think?
Well, it's been a mix. I mean, you think about things like the urbanization of the state. 80% of Texans live in cities now. Things like the youth of the state, not just the number of kids, but the number of young adults. But I think that more generally, there's this tendency in Texas to be somewhat laissez-faire about people's personal lives and cultural issues. There is, it leans in a libertarian direction on a lot of things, and it plays out in funny ways sometimes. So you'll see big controversies over texting while driving, for example, and whether we should ban that or not. But I think that in general, despite the kind of rhetoric we've heard from the Republican leadership, when it comes down, you know, to getting things done, to doing business, to working, people don't have as much time to care about what your, you know, personal beliefs or lifestyle are. They're more concerned about, you know, hey, are you working? Are you part of the community? You know, and do you assert your right to live the way you want to live with the confidence or even hubris that is common to a lot of Texans?
The subtitle of the book, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. Talk about that strange genius.
Well, we had to say strange because I thought maybe national readers would think any kind of genius described in Texas was strange. But I think, you know, there's a lot of things that Texas, I think, does do pretty well. And some things, of course, can't be replicated. But I think every state has a sort of set of advantages and disadvantages that are you know, not universally shared in the United States. So in Texas, we have ours. New York has yours, or you have yours in New York. But things like, for example, the focus we have in the state economy, it's almost like the lingua franca of the state is if you talk about something in terms of the economy, in terms of jobs it will create, in terms of investment it will generate, that becomes a bipartisan way to get things done. So you might say, we need to invest in our universities because that is what helps create the innovation of tomorrow, and that is what helps us bring businesses here. They know we have a highly educated workforce. And then suddenly you're funding universities without making an argument about human enrichment and personal growth and that kind of thing. Or even with the arts. We talk about, well, the arts bring about $6 billion a year to the state, so it's good for the economy for us to have arts in the state. And then we're supporting the arts, even though we're not phrasing it in terms of, you know, spiritual you know, experiences or aesthetic pleasure. I think that kind of focus has been good for the state because it means that we've had a pretty good employment situation. And I think, you know, I get pretty dogmatic about the jobs outlook, but I think that if you're a family, if you're working, there's really nothing more important for you than to have access to work, access to good work, access to work where you feel like you can sustain yourself and provide for yourself and for your family.
Well, the name of the book is Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. The book is published by Public Affairs. Erica Greider, a great pleasure. I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, published by Public Affairs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.